Hello, and welcome to everyone here and to everyone watching and listening online. So glad that we all could be together today in this way. Today, we are going to wrestle with a puzzling story from John chapter 5 that introduces a difficult section of the Gospel of John. And I find this story to be bothersome on multiple levels. So let's read it first, and then I'll explain why. Beginning in John 5, verse 1, it says, "Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. And one who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, Jesus asked him, 'Do you want to get well?' 'Sir,' the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred, and while I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me.' And then Jesus said to him, 'Get up, pick up your mat, and walk.' And at once the man was cured, and he picked up his mat, and he walked. The day on which this took place was a Sabbath. And so the Jewish leaders said to the man who had been healed, 'It is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat.' But he replied, 'Well, the man who made me well said to me, pick up your mat and walk.' And so they asked him, 'Who is this fellow who told you to pick it up and walk?' And the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, 'See, you are well again. Now stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you.' The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who had made him well. And so because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, 'My Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working.' For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God." Jesus' initial question to this man at the pool has always seemed a bit odd to me. "Do you want to get well?" He's been disabled for 38 years, and day after day he's been sitting by that pool of water, which is supposed to have magical properties, hoping that when the water is stirred, he can be the first one in the pool, because that's what the legend says would happen, so that he could be healed. Of course he wants to get well. Why would Jesus ask him this question? But there's a clue in the way the man responds. His answer is, pardon the pun, kind of lame. Because he responds with an excuse. And it's a whiny one at that. He doesn't say, "Yes, I'd love to be healed." He says, "Oh, I can't be healed. Someone always gets into the water first, and no one will help me into the water." And at this point, we could pause and psychologize this response. We could explore how this man's disability has become the dominant trait of his personality, how it is now the basis for his identity. He is forever fused with this idea of being the one who will never get into the water first. I'm sure his sad story moved others to generosity. I'm sure he had developed quite a livelihood by sitting next to that pool and never being healed. But that's not what this story's about. It's about what Jesus does next and the way the man responds and the way the religious leaders respond after Jesus takes action. Because Jesus says, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." And to his credit, the man does exactly what he's told. And then he almost immediately gets in trouble with the religious leaders for carrying his mat, which, according to their interpretation of the law of Moses, is a form of work which is prohibited on the Sabbath. And when they confront him, though, he says, "Don't blame me. I'm just doing what I was told by the guy who healed me." And the religious leaders want to know, "Well, who is it that told you to carry your mat?" Not who is it that healed you after 38 years of being disabled. It's who told you you could carry your mat? Who would dare disregard our interpretation? Who would dare undermine our authority and tell you that you could carry your mat on the Sabbath? The man doesn't know because Jesus disappeared into the crowd, and apparently the man didn't do any research afterward to find out. And after this encounter with the religious leaders, Jesus finds the man again in the temple. And he warns him, "You better stop sinning or something worse will happen to you." In the Gospel of John, the primary sin that Jesus repeatedly confronts is disbelief or unbelief, especially in those who hear his words or see his wondrous signs and yet still never believe in him or the one who has sent him. That's the major sin in the Gospel of John. Separation from God because of an unwillingness or an inability to recognize who Jesus is and what Jesus is doing on earth. And so Jesus warns this man, who he has just healed. He says, "You're well now, but something worse could happen to you than getting in trouble with the religious leaders because you're breaking their Sabbath law. And that worst thing is you could come under judgment of God because you are not believing in the one he has sent." Jesus takes the initiative, seeks out this man, finds him, and then warns him about the consequences of his unbelief, just as he took the initiative to heal him. Both are demonstrations of God's grace. Remember in the prologue, John says that in Jesus we see grace upon grace upon grace, abundant grace overflowing out of the life of Jesus. And both are demonstrations of this abundant grace of God, because sometimes God's grace heals us. And sometimes grace warns us. God's grace is both proactive, taking the initiative, and it is persistent, continually circling back around to warn us. Because God's grace cannot let us go. Henry Nouwen tells an old story about an old man who every morning would get up and sit next to a river on the riverbank and meditate. And one morning, as he finished his meditation, he looked out on the river and he saw a scorpion floating helplessly on the water. And so the man grabbed a tree limb and leaned out over the water and tried to rescue the scorpion. But of course, when he grabbed the scorpion stung him. He pulled his hand back in pain and he regained his balance and he stretched out again, and again, the scorpion stung him, this time causing his hand to swell. And a passerby saw all of this happening and shouted to the old man, "Why are you risking your life to rescue that ungrateful scorpion?" And the old man said, "Just because it's the scorpion's nature to sting does not change my nature to save." God's grace is proactive and God's grace is persistent. And how does this man who has been healed by Jesus respond to the proactive, persistent grace of God? How does he respond to this warning, a gracious warning? He goes to the religious leaders and says, "It was Jesus who healed me." And not because he wants them to hear the good news about Jesus. He's not the Samaritan woman going back into the village saying, "You've got to come see this guy. You've got to come hear what he has to say." No, he goes and tells them who Jesus is, either because he wants them to leave him alone because they're pestering him, or because his loyalties, in fact, lie with them and not with Jesus. Whatever his motives, the result is they start persecuting Jesus. And then when Jesus defends himself, they conspire to kill him. In this way, this man whom Jesus healed is a precursor to Judas. Judas, who was with Jesus, who followed Jesus, who listened to all of Jesus' teachings, who saw all of Jesus' signs, and in the end still handed him over to the religious leaders who wanted to kill him. By now, it's obvious I'm not a huge fan of this guy that Jesus heals. And if you think I'm being too hard on him, go and compare the way he responds to the grace of God with the way the man born blind responds to being healed by Jesus in John chapter 9, which we'll get to in a couple of weeks. See, one of the ways that John makes a point as he tells his story is he will set up comparisons between two characters. And you really don't get what John is saying until you read both stories about both characters and compare and contrast them. For example, John's negative portrayal of Nicodemus, a religious insider who comes to Jesus at night, isn't clarified fully until we compare it with the way the Samaritan woman responds in chapter 4. And in the same way, we don't realize how lackluster this man's response is to being healed by Jesus until we compare it with the way the man born blind responds in John chapter 9. Of all of the people sitting around that pool that Jesus could have healed, you'd think he could find someone more deserving, or at least more grateful and loyal to Jesus afterward. So here I am reading this story. And if I've done my job, made my case, here we are reading this story. I really want us to be on the same team for this one. I'm not going down by myself. Here we are reading this story and standing in judgment of the way this man responds to the grace of God. Which also means we're standing in judgment of the way Jesus wastes this grace on this undeserving, ungrateful man. Is this really the position we want to take in response to this story? Standing in judgment of the way Jesus pours out the grace of God on others. You know who else in the story stands in judgment of Jesus and the way he pours out the grace of God on others? The religious leaders who not only persecute Jesus but finally decide they want to kill him. I don't like the guy Jesus chose to heal. They don't like when Jesus chose to heal him. And to both of us, Jesus says, "I really don't care what you think. I did not come here to please you. I did not come here to solidify all of your traditional interpretations of the law. I came to show you what God is like. I came to do the will of my Father. I came to do on earth what I see my Father doing in heaven. And what I see is my Father giving life. However, whenever, and to whomever he pleases, and so I'm doing the same." He says in chapter 5, verse 21, "For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he is pleased to give it." In other words, Jesus says, "I really don't care what you think. I'm just doing what I see my Father in heaven doing. Back in verse 8, when Jesus tells the man to get up, that word that's translated get up is a form of the word that's translated as raises the dead or raises in verse 21. It's a resurrection word. And this, like so many other stories in the Gospel of John, is ultimately a resurrection story. Jesus is giving life to this dead man, this man's dead legs, just as his Father gives life to the dead. Jesus is doing what he sees his Father in heaven doing. He's bringing life where there is none. He's speaking words of light into the darkness, speaking words of life into the desolate reality. And Jesus says, I will do it whenever and however and to whomever I please. And then in the second part of chapter 5, if you keep reading through it, what you see is Jesus confronting and denouncing the religious leaders for their sin of unbelief. And it is a harsh critique. And it gets even harsher in chapter 7 and 8. That's why I say this is such a difficult section of the Gospel of John. Jesus is constantly at odds and having a war of words with the religious leaders, especially those in Jerusalem. Much like the man he's just healed, they are seeing Jesus, they are hearing Jesus' words, and yet they refuse to believe. They are blind to the truth about Jesus, even though Jesus says there are a number of witnesses, like John the Baptist, like all his miraculous signs, like the scriptures themselves, all of them are pointing to Jesus, and the religious leaders cannot see the truth. It says in verse 39 of chapter 5, it says, you study the scriptures diligently. Oh, you know your Bibles. You study the scriptures diligently because you think that in them you have eternal life. And these are the very scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me and have life. Their way of reading the Bible causes them to see only a man carrying his mat on the Sabbath and completely miss that the man has been healed after 38 years of infirmity and completely miss the good news behind that about who Jesus is and where he's come from and what he's come to do. All they can see is someone is breaking the rules. How can they be so blind? They cannot see Jesus for who he is, even though there is a mountain of evidence and a community of witnesses pointing to him. How can they not see it? The grace of God is right there in front of them, and they're missing it. So here I am again. Or better yet, here we are again, not committing this crime by myself, reading this story and standing in judgment of the way the religious leaders cannot see who Jesus really is. Whether we're focused on the unworthiness of the man Jesus heals or we're focused on the blindness of the religious leaders, it doesn't matter because we're still not focusing on the one to whom all the signs point, the one who came to show us what God is really like and is doing on earth what he sees his Father doing in heaven. We're not seeing that. We're just seeing the inadequate ways that others are responding to the grace of God. And it makes us feel a little better about ourselves because we would never do that. And while we're focused on their inadequate responses to God's grace, we are also not then focusing on our response to God's grace. I have a friend with this annoying habit. We'll get together sometimes and talk about people we know, and we'll talk about their blind spots. We'll talk about their lack of self-awareness. We'll talk about how they are saying and doing foolish and destructive things, and they seem to be unaware of the impact they're having on their own life, their family, the world around them. They're clueless. We talk about how clueless they are. How can they be so blind? And it makes us feel a little better about ourselves. And then my friend will bring the conversation at some point. He will bring it back around and he'll say this, which makes me wonder, where are my blind spots? What am I missing? What foolish things am I saying and doing that's causing all kinds of trouble for myself and others, and I can't see it? And that's when I jump in and begin listing all of his flaws that are obvious to me. No, it's so much easier to judge this ungrateful man that Jesus heals than it is to consider all the ways we fail to acknowledge and show gratitude for God's grace at work in our lives every day. It is so much easier to shake our heads at the blindness at the religious leaders instead of acknowledging and confessing how easy it is for us to misread and misinterpret and misuse Scripture, which then causes us to miss what God is doing right in front of us. God's grace is proactive. It heals, it forgives, it saves. Not only when we don't deserve it, but long before we even ask for it. God's grace is also persistent. It warns. It keeps coming back around and warning us. And maybe for some of us, this story is God's grace in the form of a warning. Warning us that we can read about grace in the Bible, we can talk about it in our sermons and classes, we can sing about it in our songs, we can experience God's grace. We can receive God's grace and still not allow it to touch our hearts or transform our lives. So instead of judging others and the way they respond to God's grace, let's look inward today and consider our response to the grace of God. May God's proactive and persistent grace move us to pledge our undying allegiance and loyalty to Jesus, the one who gives us life and the one who makes us whole. Let's stand and sing.